Okay, then I will start. So I'm Paul from the Academy of Democratic Modernity. Today we will try to speak for 1.5 to 2 hours about the paradigm of democratic modernity and also its perspectives for a new internationalism. So before I start, maybe for the method, it will be partly a presentation and maybe also a lot of content. So I try not to go too deep, but at the same time also give a good overview of the things. So maybe before we start, I would like to ask if any one of you, or if you could raise your hand, if you have heard before about Kurdistan Freedom Movement, paradigm of democratic modernity, because according to this, I will adopt a bit. Okay. Kind of half-half, okay. Yes, so because also I will maybe go a little bit before to talk about the concepts and the theory of democratic modernity, which is the paradigm of the Kurdistan Freedom Movement, also a little bit about the struggle in Kurdistan, just to show also where it came from for the comrades here that maybe have not so much information about it from before. Okay, we have some technical problems, but I think I will just start maybe. So yes, so I think here in this very historic and important meeting that we came together, 150 years of Anarchist International also, we choose to talk about that subject because also the Kurdistan Freedom Movement has this analysis of the anarchist movements of being one of their main strategical partners and strategical alliance in the struggle against capitalist modernity. And I think also what all of us brings us together here is actually that we see a very deep crisis of capitalist modernity, of the capitalist system. So in that sense also, I think it can be a very important contribution to also the discussions in the anarchist movement. What are the ideas that were developed by 50 years of struggle in Kurdistan? And also, of course, in the same time, also the democratic modernity paradigm, which was mainly developed by Öcalan, Abdullah Öcalan, the leader also of the Kurdish Liberation Movement, was also in many sites a lot inspired by anarchist thinkers, anarchist activists or militants. So in that sense also Öcalan used always to say, I'm like the student of all the revolutionary struggles in history. And as you know, maybe some of you have also read his defense writings, especially that he wrote in the last 25 years on the Imrali Island. 13 of them are published so far in Turkish. Here also he quotes a lot of anarchist thinkers like Bakunin, Bookchin, Kropotkin, Emma Goldman, and many more of them. I would say he was very much inspired, but maybe not even mentioning them. So in that sense also, I think, yeah, we thought to share this concepts and ideas, and I would also really like if we can manage to have questions and discussions then after the first and second block. Yes, maybe first, also before starting with the history of the Kurdistan Liberation Movement, one really important point also about the paradigm, I think, is that it's not only a theory, but devolved from a struggle. So it is also an accumulation of experiences and also a synthesis of a lot of other thoughts. And at the same time, I might say that it also started with the question, actually, of how to live. Or the question of what is the right revolutionary leadership, what is the right approach to how to actually build a free life and a democratic free society. Yes, and this struggle that this paradigm also evolved from started in the 70s with the involvement of PKK, so the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And yes, maybe now I don't have this. Now it works. Yes, you can go to the map of Kurdistan. So yeah, to understand how the struggle started, maybe I will go a little bit to history, because also we have another very, very important anniversary tomorrow. Tomorrow, not very far from here in Lausanne. Exactly 100 years ago, different European imperial states came together made the so-called Treaty of Lausanne, which was actually the treaty that divided the Middle East, Mesopotamia, Kurdistan in its middle, into different nation states. And it's actually the anniversary of 100 years colonially divided Kurdistan. Also yesterday there was a big demonstration. Some also from here went there by bus and car yesterday and joined the demonstration with 10,000 Kurdish people from all over Europe. So yeah, we see here this map of Kurdistan. And the actual problem also from which the struggle started was to say that Kurdistan is a colony. And this has started just 100 years ago, 100 kilometers from here. So I think it's also another historical moment that we are actually talking about the subject today. So yeah, and in this treaty, Kurdistan was divided into the Turkish, Syrian, Iraqi, and Iranian nation state. Yes, this treaty was not only dividing it in different nation states, but in fact also, was the soil for 100 years of genocides, assimilation, and also of denial of the Kurdish people and many other people in the region. Like Aramaic people, Syriac people, Armenian peoples, and in this sense, yes, it's a very historic moment. I don't go too much in the history, but especially from in the 20s and 30s, we had a lot of genocides against the Kurdish people. Also in 1915, the Seyfo against the Armenian and Syriac people. And after that, out of this genocides, also the Turkish Republic was built. And for a very long time, like in the 30s especially, with a few other genocides like the Dersim genocide, we can say that in Kurdistan a really, kind of silence, spread. And for many decades, we had almost the impossibility to even talk about Kurdistan, about being Kurdish, to even use the Kurdish language. And especially against this situation, in the 70s, a group of young students around Abdullah Öcalan came together with the thesis I just said, Kurdistan is a colony and we need to liberate it. Maybe for this period of time also it's important to mention, it was a time where we had really, really strong socialist youth movement in Turkey. So we had like the Revolutionary Youth Federation of almost 500,000 people. And also NATO, of course, had not really big interest in these developments. So we had a lot of repression by the Turkish fascist state and at the same time by NATO forces. And at the same time also different Kurdish groups, movements started to ask at least for reforms and for the rights of Kurdish people. And out of this legacy, let's say, of socialist ideas, socialist youth revolution of 68, but also of different Kurdish liberation groups, this group of students about Abdullah Öcalan came together. So when we talk about the history of the party or the history of Kurdish liberation movement, we can talk about four main strategical phases. I will mention those only, not to go too deep in the history. So in the beginning, the first group that you can also see here started to actually become a party, to build an organization, because it was clear in order to fight the colonialism in Kurdistan, you can only win if you are organized, if you create consciousness, and if you build a really strong ideological understanding also of how to actually decolonize Kurdistan. So the first years were mainly about this. And in 78, also after 5 years, the PKK got officially founded. Here you see also the little house that it was found. Part of this period also was the prison resistance. So after the big military coup in 1980, many people were arrested. Many socialist movements got destroyed. And up to 650,000 people got detained after the military coup of 1980, which was like a NATO coup, we can say. And also most of the main militants of the Kurdistan Freedom Movement in that time got arrested and were put to the dungeon of Ahmet, which was like a torture dungeon. Maybe some of you have watched the movie 14th of July. It talks about the hunger strike and the resistance there. And this is also an important moment to understand not only the theoretical foundation of the movement, which was in that time mostly Marxist-Leninist, and according to the ideas of national liberation struggles, inspired by a lot of other struggles in the world, from Vietnam to Angola to other places like Cuba. But it also shows the great resistance and the strong will of the first militants that actually managed to resist against all the torture in the prison. And this had a huge impact then, both on the popular organization outside, but also on the militants that, with together with Öcalan, around 200, 300 comrades, went to Palestine or Lebanon in the Beka Valley to try to rebuild the organization, which we see here, where they built an academy in Beka Valley. And so also this prison resistance gave a lot of strength to kind of rebuild the organization from there. Yes, and in that period also, the main part of the ideology, we can say, or the main philosophy also of the movement was found in that academy. And in that academy, Öcalan stayed from 79 to 99. Later they moved to Damascus and trained up to 20, 30,000 people, militants, but also people from the Popular Front and so on. And out of this process also, later the armed struggle in 84 started, and at the same time also the organizing of the people. So this strategical phases was also called a revival and resistance phase. So actually to claim that the Kurdish identity exists, and to also give strength and give hope back to the people to be able to actually fight the colonization. And I think for this period it's also very, it's a good example maybe to see that when the first comrades went to Kurdistan in the 70s, 75, they were talking to an old Kurdish man and told him about Kurdistan, independent socialism, and the old man just said, look, a dead tree won't blossom again. But especially in the 80s we see, after also the armed resistance against the Turkish colonialism started, the movement became bigger and bigger, and especially also in Europe, a lot of people started to organize. So we had like 10 to hundreds of thousands of people also in the demonstrations in Europe. Yeah, this maybe for this phases. This phase was also a phase of a very intense guerrilla warfare with the Turkish state, and there was a lot of difficulties within the movement, both internally, patriarchal mentality, gang mentality in the guerrilla, a lot of problem also, of course, of how to actually build also self-governance or self-organization in the liberated areas by guerrilla. So especially in the 90s, after the collapse of Soviet Union and the real socialism, there was a lot of, reflection of how to actually do the revolution and how to also succeed with the goal of a free, democratic and socialist Kurdistan, which before was more seen by achieving a nation state, achieving like development for Kurdistan. But especially in the 90s, after the collapse of real socialism, there was a lot of reflection about that. So also I think mainly from anarchist point of view also, there was a lot of discussion about how to deal with the state. Is our goal to build a Kurdish nation state, or is our goal to actually get rid of the mentality of state, the mentality of patriarchy that is behind the state? So there was a lot of discussion about this, and also the question of the method, how to reach it. And since the... One moment. Yes, and since the guerrilla struggle also had caused a lot of loss, in 93, Öcalan decided to call for a first unilateral ceasefire, which was then also repeated up to eight times in the 90s, but the Turkish state never answered to it. And at the same time, inside the organization, there was a lot of reflections in different Congress and in the academies, especially about the question of women's liberation, of the question of how to achieve socialism without a state, and also a lot of discussion internally, how to actually, what is the method of building self-organization of the people, without waiting for the revolution to happen. So much more to think, what is actually, how to build our utopia today already. And these discussions in the 90s, I could say, are also the foundation for the later shift of paradigm. So yeah, when Öcalan then got arrested in 99 by international conspiracy, by a lot of different intelligence service of different nation states, especially NATO, but also other states that were involved in it. And he was actually given to Turkish nation state, and since then is imprisoned for 25 years on Imrali Island. He actually deepened also these discussions and analysis, and he wrote 13 books, which are actually defense writings to different courts, like to the Turkish court, Greek court, and most of them to the European, so-called European Court of, what's it called, human rights? Yes. And so, yeah, it was the only way for him to actually bring his ideas outside. And the main book he wrote, is one of it is called Beyond State Power and Violence in English, and the other five, the Manifesto for a Democratic Civilization. We have also a book stand over there where you can get them if you want later. And yeah, in these defense writings, he developed the paradigm of democratic modernity, and especially its political proposal of democratic confederalism, which is also very much inspired, how you know, also by other anarchist or also more anti-authoritarian communist movements, or also at the same time a lot of traditions and experiences from the Middle East itself, also of how Kurdish tribes, for example, were organizing. And yes, here you see one of the maps of all the organizations that then later developed out of this new proposal of democratic confederalism. So in 2005, in Ahmet, in North Kurdistan, Turkish part of Kurdistan, there was the call out of the new strategy of democratic confederalism. And yeah, out of this, also the Democratic Society Congress, for example, in North Kurdistan was found. And a lot of other organizations were built that I will not go so deep in it now. Yes, and out of this also the Rojava Revolution afterwards evolved. And what we can see at the same time is that the Turkish nation state never really accepted this democratization or also the democratic solution approach of the Kurdistan Freedom Movement in order to sit down and find a solution for it. So the repression went on, both in North Kurdistan, in South Kurdistan, in the mountains, but also especially in Syria then, with using, or in Iraq and Syria, with using the IS. And therefore also the new strategy after 2010 became a revolutionary people's war, or revolutionary people's struggle. So to, at one side, build your own democratic autonomy, but also to have your self-defense in order to defend it, and to involve all the society into this. Yesterday, for example, there was also a discussion here on dual power, counter power. I think it's very similar to this understanding also of building your own alternative, not waiting for the revolution to happen.
Maybe say it a sentence by sentence and keep a bit of eye contact.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, maybe one.
Yes, here you see also in northeast Syria, in Rojava, one of the results of the new paradigm was the autonomous administration of northeast Syria. I think most of you know about it. As I said, I won't go so much into practice. Then, yeah, important part of the development is also the women's revolution. So also out of the 90s, already before the paradigm shift, a lot of autonomous women's organizations were built, a women's army, later also a women's party. And yeah, also this is the foundation actually of why also today Rojava is called the women's revolution. And also we have in Iran and East Kurdistan since last autumn a revolution with the slogan Jinjian Azadi, women, life, freedom, which was very important development out of the paradigm shift. And here you see also the revolutionary youth movement, which is also autonomously organized. Is also played a very important role, especially in North Kurdistan, in building democratic autonomy between 2005 and 15, especially of the self-administration process in North Kurdish cities that were crashed down very heavily by the military in 2015-16. And also in Rojava, they played a very important role in building the self-defense forces. Yes, there may be one other dimension also to mention here is that there was a lot of international participation since the 90s already in the revolution in Kurdistan, both from other peoples from Middle East, but also from outside, so from other nations in the world, so especially from Europe. We have, for example, Andrea Wolf here, that she was killed by the Turkish state in a battle in 97 and has now also 25 years anniversary this year. And other comrades, Anna Campbell, Michael Panzer, and Alina Sanchez from England, Germany, and Argentina. So they were also international comrades, part also of taking part in the struggle in Kurdistan, but also spreading the ideas, building bridges to other movements in the world. Yeah, then maybe for the actual situation, just shortly, I mentioned already also that there was a big demonstration yesterday for 100 years of colonization after the Treaty of Lausanne. But at the same time, also 3 days ago, a new big military operation or intensification of military operation of the Turkish state started in the Free Mountains of Kurdistan, so in South Kurdistan. And so only within one day, there were 630 bombings and 80 helicopters that tried to drop military forces. So this is very actual situation also. We have very strong crackdown on all the democratic society organizing in North Kurdistan. In East Kurdistan, we know also a lot of executions, a lot of repression. South Kurdistan, which is also the attempt of NATO to build like a little Kurdistan that fits to their neoliberal ideas. And also in Europe, we have very strong criminalization and repression against the Kurdish diaspora organization. But at the same time, of course, there is very strong resistance and the struggle goes on. But I think also we see that, yesterday it was also mentioned in the discussion on dual power, when you reach a certain level that you can have a radical alternative to capitalist modernity, of course, the different nation states, NATO, Russia, will not look at it very happily. In this sense, there's a lot of attacks by all the different nation states and imperial forces. Yes, maybe you can start with questions first. For this part on history, if you have questions, I think it was a lot of information. So if some things were not well understood or you have questions or contributions also, we can open the round first time before I go more to the paradigm and the theory of democratic modernity. I will repeat. So he was asking if I can explain which are the east, west, south, and north of Kurdistan. So just to answer shortly. So North Kurdistan is occupied by Turkey. West is Rojava, northeast Syria. South is Iraq, and east is Iran. Sorry, yeah.
Just a basic question. I wanted to know which...
So North Kurdistan, Turkey, West Syria, South Iraq, and East Iran.
Just a basic question. Which nation states came together 100 years ago in Lausanne to divide Kurdistan?
Maybe other questions before? Okay, yeah, I don't know the whole list, but especially Great Britain, France. Do you know what were all the states? Yes, only those, Russia, Germany, like the different European imperial forces. There was also Turkey and also some Kurdish delegates, but they did not really represent an own organization and political identity. They were there more for the delegation of Turkey also, or Ottoman in that sense, in that time.
Because you are talking about like now, like Kurdistan is facing attacking. Do you think the attack in Paris was done from just a racist killer, or was it, or was really the Kurdistan movement who was targeted? And also, what's happening? You know, like these countries joining the NATO. That Turkish is like making deals about having a Kurdistan movement to be a terrorist. You know what I mean?
No, no, you can. I mean, you can also open some more questions like this in the end again. Yes, for the murder in Paris that the comrade was talking about, maybe for the ones that don't know about it. So in 2013 already, there was an assassination of three women comrades from the Kurdish women's movement. One was Sakine Jansız, which was also founder of PKK, so one of the first women within the movement, that she has a very long legacy of struggle. There's also a movie about her life, My Whole Life is a Struggle. You find it on YouTube. Yeah, My Whole Life is a Struggle. And two more women, one Fidan Doğan, that she was very important for building relationships with the French civil society and different movements. And also Leyla Şeylemez, that she was part of the young women's movement. So this happened in 2013, and it's obvious that they were killed by a meat agent. He later died from cancer in the prison. But later also some responsibles of MIT, the military intelligence of Turkey, even said themselves that they were the ones that gave the order for it. So this is kind of clear more or less today, but it's still not officially by the justice of French state discovered, but because they didn't make any investigation about it. And then now 10 years later, in December, there was another assassination of three comrades in the middle of Paris, in the Kurdish association there. It was Haval Evin and two more also comrades, one artist and one like sympathizer of the movement or activist of the movement in Paris. And especially also the attack was targeting Haval Evin, which she is also very important woman militant of the women's movement. And we can say it was very clear targeting especially her, and it was actually targeting also a meeting for organizing the 10 years anniversary or memorial of the murders 10 years ago. So maybe there could have been even much more people or more comrades been killed. Yeah, and the killer that was then caught, he was a French racist, but very interesting is also he was in prison just before and released a week before. So we don't know. But it's possible that he was, for example, recruited also by Turkish Secret Service in prison. We don't know. But it is most probably. And at the same time, also, even if it wasn't like planned by Turkish Secret Service, we see also that the new right and also the Islamo-fascist right, fascist forces, are getting more close to each other in the last years. There's certain publications also on these points. I don't go so deep in it. In the sense, it's anyway for sure a femicide, and it's also a political assassination against the freedom movement. So I think it's not contradictory to be racist, patriarchal, and anti-revolutionary, fascist. But we don't know exactly how it was organized. Yes. Okay. Maybe if there's no more questions now, I will go on a bit. But you can also ask again later on. Yeah, so we have the slide here on Sociology of Freedom. It's one of the main books also I can suggest to read if you want to get a bit more insight of the things I'm going to talk about. It's the main kind of international manifesto also of Öcalan, where he's talking about main principles of this paradigm of democratic modernity. Yes, Sociology of Freedom, at the same time, was also his proposal for a new understanding of social science, alternative social science that is actually serving the to solve the problems of society rather than being a tool of oppression as modern sociology, positivist sociology is nowadays. But at the same time, it's also his proposal of renewal of the question of socialism, democratic, scientific socialism. And maybe just for the term socialism also, here again, I said already, it's like non-state understanding of socialism and the understanding of actually an organized democratic society that has is aware of its moral political fabric, what I will talk about later on. Yeah, and one very important point also that I tried to mention in the beginning already, that the paradigm evolved from the struggle, is that one important fundament also of the philosophy of Öcalan is especially to look for what you, to look for the things inside yourself. Or he says also, if you have lost something, you need to go where you have lost in order to find the solution. So most of its method also, I think also learning a lot from Marx or other anarchist. Most of his books that he wrote in prison are actually very, very long analysis also of history. So I think one really important point also of understanding democratic modernity paradigm is to look into history to get to know also our legacy and our, our heritage of actually the life or society outside of patriarchy, state, class, the capitalist centralist civilization. So here I have a little map that some comrades from Germany also made that is a bit showing also his understanding of history. So in his defense writings, he talks about the contradiction between two civilizations, where he says Marx has analyzed history by class contradiction, where he also agrees, but he says there's even something more deeper than this. And this is actually the contradiction between the system of patriarchy, state, class, and cities, or urbanized cities, and on the other side, communities, people, societies that he calls also moral political society. And yes, and here he talks about kind of two rivers. So a river where we started from also, of society, communal life, resistance on one side. Also, for example, I think David Graeber in his book, The Dawn of Everything, it's very much trying to go deep into this understanding, which was also a big friend and also supporter of the campaign for freedom of Öcalan. And then on the other side, we have the river of what he called centralist civilization that started, as he says, from Sumer and the first city-states. And yes, so he says we have a constant contradiction between the both without history, throughout history. And also today, when we look at on these two rivers, he talks about democratic modernity and capitalist modernity, kind of contradiction and the contradiction between the both. So like the actual continuation of these two rivers. And in this understanding again also, he understands democratic modernity as actually the actual situation that we live in of alternatives to the system and communities, peoples organizing outside of capitalist civilization. And he talks here about three main pillars when he talks about democratic modernity. One is the moral political society that he says is kind of trying to be an alternative to capitalism. So when he talks about moral, he means actually social values, the way of the society can solve its own problems, find methods for this. And when he talks about politics, it's mainly about being able actually to determine your own life, to discuss, debate, organize, self-organize, politics in that sense, self-organization. Yes, and he has also different names for that. Then the second pillar he talks about in his paradigm of democratic modernity is the eco-industry, also ecological social ecology, we can say, which he says is also his alternative to the industrialism of the nation-state capitalist modernity. And the third one is the democratic confederalism, also democratic nation, which he says is his alternative to the understanding of nation-state and nationalism. And I will now go a bit deeper in those. Yeah, so for more political society, I said a few points already. He also, in his understanding of the contradiction between the state and society, he gives, there's this quote of him where he also talks about how the state tries to destroy moral by putting law instead of it. So actually taking the ability of a community to solve its problems by itself and determine its own social values by itself, and then making up laws and a state monopoly of repression instead of actually making the people able to solve their problems by themselves. I think best example for this is the 3 years of Corona pandemic we had, how they were also really like trying to take all the ability of us to solve social problems by ourselves. And yeah, for politics also, he calls kind of the opposite of democratic politics and self-organization. He calls it state administration. So yes, in this sense, also we can see that the state is actually the more stronger, the less the society is able to have a strong moral and politic fabric. And the state is weaker when the society has very strong moral and political fabric. So in this sense, this dual understanding also. Yeah, then very important part of the concept is also the role of self-defense, where he talks about the theory of the rose. So the rose, which is very beautiful, but has also thorns to defend itself. Yes, and so in this sense, also a society that has very strong moral political fabric, he says, is able to defend itself against colonization and has a strong consciousness and is organized. So self-defense is not only about weapons and physical self-defense, but also of being having a strong consciousness and being organized to be able to self-determine your life. Yeah, for ecology and eco-industry, I won't go so deep in it, but one important point is to understand that it's not to be against industry or against technology, but the bigger question is how to use it. So how to actually use it for social needs and also according to ecological consciousness. So it's not anti-industry or anti-technology, but the main social question, he says, is how to actually be able to find a society approach that this technology industry are serving the needs of society. Okay, next one. Yeah, then for democratic confederalism, I will go a bit more deeper in this one maybe because there's a lot of questions and interest always. What is also the main principles of it is radical democracy, women's liberation, and social ecology. Kind of, against the ideas of nationalism, social sexism, and also the ecological debasement of capitalist modernity. And one important kind of formula in the understanding of democratic confederalism is the formula of state plus democracy, which is not like reformist understanding of having state and a bit of democracy, but the idea that the stronger the state is, the weaker the democracy, so the self-organization of the people is, and the stronger the democracy is, the weaker the state is. So this dual understanding. Yes, and in this framework, he talks about two terms, democratic autonomy and democratic nation, where he says democratic autonomy is actually the safe organization of people. It can be little groups, communities, neighborhoods, whole nations, or bigger things like this. And it's more like the structure of it, the body. And then he has another concept, which is the democratic nation, where he talks more about consciousness, culture, mentality of democratic confederalism. And the main goal is to be able to build self-organization of the society in all fields of life in order to push back the state. So the idea is the more stronger we organize ourselves, the weaker the state will become. And at the same time, of course, you will need self-defense for this, which is one dimension of it. Yes, and especially for the for the body, I mean, many of you have heard about it. Maybe he talks about four main pillars: communes, councils, cooperatives, and academies. So commune as the lowest cell or the little cell of the daily practice of democratic confederalism, organized neighborhoods, villages, or maybe even communes of education, women's communes, youth communes. Then the councils, which are kind of the federation of the different communes, the academies for the mental revolution, for discussing together how to strengthen the democratic self-organization, and also the cooperatives for the production and for the taking care of the of the needs of society, and to also build an alternative cooperative economy outside of the capitalist logic. And then within this democratic confederal system, I showed for before also the Democratic Society Congress in North Kurdistan. There can be also different other, in the councils, can be different other layers of different autonomous women's organizations taking part in it, youth organizations, but also different autonomous organizations, federations of cultural identities. So for example, in Northeast Syria, you would have Kurds, Arabs, Cherkess, Turkmen, Syriac, Armenian, Arab people, that they have also their own confederal structures, but coming together in a common congress. And also all kinds of other civil societies that can be part of these councils in order to have People's Congress that brings together all the different organizations of society. Yeah, and this is bottom up. So the more important is to build a strong base and solve the problems on the lower level, not only top down. Yeah, and then here some of the dimensions. There's a lot of them now, but maybe can you go one back? For the democratic nation term also. Now many will say, what is this? Democracy and nation. Here he also says, for example, in one of his books, that he's not using these terms very dogmatically. So it's more a proposal. If there's other ideas, which terms to use for this meaning, he's also open to have others. But democracy, again, he understands as self-organization of the people. And nation also not in the sense of nation state, but of different communities that are also reality, that they have an own history, own language, own identity, but not based on othering, that it's like about being different to the others, but to be yourself. There's also the concept of Khwabun, being yourself. And the understanding of democratic nation then is to actually create a nation that is not only based on ethnicity, but on common consciousness, on a common understanding and mentality of wanting to live together in a democratic way. So the more important point is the democratic rather than nation. But nation is kind of then the community which is self-organized. For example, in Rojava, in northeast Syria, there's a concrete social contract that people agreed on together So this is kind of, we can say maybe that what is like the formulation of the common consciousness of that democratic nation, where different nations can be part of. So sometimes also Kurdish comrades give the example of Switzerland, that it's similar. Maybe some of the people in the beginning had similar ideas. I guess bourgeoisie kind of turned it totally into very bourgeoisie nation-state understanding again, unfortunately. But yeah, also there are some other even states that have similar understanding of nation, not racial, ethnic, but yeah. Anyway, this is another discussion. But here is the proposal of the new understanding of that also, especially for Middle East, very, very important, because the imperialists, Lausanne Treaty, have always tried to use the different peoples against each other for the imperial goals in that region. Yes, here I will not go so deep in it, but these are some of the dimensions Öcalan mentions that can be organized also in the different commissions of the communes and councils, and that are dimensions that he proposes to specifically try to organize in order to build like alternatives, radical alternatives to the state. Yeah, then I mentioned before already, also within that paradigm, the vanguard role of women is very, very important. So I mentioned that they have complete autonomous organized confederate structures and also own women's party, organization and army. And in this sense also, especially the theory of self-defense is the base of the women's liberation ideology, and also the understanding of fighting patriarchy in the mentality. So there's also the concept of killing the dominant man, where Öcalan says this is actually the principle for building socialism. So the question of fighting patriarchy is very much the core of everything when it comes to fighting state, the mentality of capitalism, and also of how to actually make a conscious mentality revolution within the society in order to build then the structure. And in that sense, the women's liberation movement plays a very important role also to, how it's called in English, to shatter masculine patterns in the society. And in this sense, especially genealogy is like one of the proposals also made in the book Sociology of Freedom, to create a women's science, like a science from women concerned with the question of women in history, in society, and in that sense also a science of life that tries to organize the science from a woman's perspective, to reclaim women's history also, and have a new approach to sociological questions. And this is also now, out of this proposal also a huge network of genealogy faculties, institutes, academies have developed both in Kurdistan and Middle East, but also internationally and in Europe. Yeah, and of course, what I said in the beginning, also the women's revolution in Rojilat, East Kurdistan and Iran is one of the best examples of this. Yes, I don't know if I make questions now or I go one point more. Is there some questions for this part now?
Is there institutes in Europe that concern their studies and their science with the genealogy? Or is it mainly based from Kurdistan?
Maybe I collect questions and I answer. Is there other questions? Maybe we can collect some and I answer.
How are the two revolutions in Iran and Kurdistan connected? Like, how are they, I don't know, how are the relations between each other?
Okay, for the first question, as I said, genealogy as a committee was mainly found, if I'm not wrong, in the Kurdistan mountains by the women guerrilla. But then later also they start to build committees, different parts of Kurdistan. They have an institute and a magazine in Istanbul. In Rojava, there are several faculties, also in the university, local regional academies, and it's also part of the curriculum of this normal school, for example, and all the academies of the democratic confederate system, also military everywhere. It's like standard. Then in South Kurdistan, you have a library and an institute. 6 months ago, one of the main comrades that built it up was also assassinated in the middle of the day by a Turkish agent. Sheikh Zilan, she's called. And yeah, in East Kurdistan, it's more clandestine, I think. And then in Europe, in Brussels, you have a genealogy center. And they're organizing different conferences, camps, seminars, research groups in different countries. And outside of this, I don't know if... I think Latin America, there was also several education camps. And then I think also there's few professors or like official academics that put also genealogy into the curriculum of state universities. Like in Germany, France, there was some project like this. Yes, and the other question... Roji, was East Kurdistan, no? Yes, so I'm not an expert. The other day also another comrade was here from Iran that he made a lecture on it. I think he talked a bit about it. So from history on, of course, there was always a lot of exchange between the peoples of the region. And also, especially in the history also, I think PKK went to East Kurdistan and Iran 79 already. So since that time, there's exchange with different revolutionary organizations. But of course, there was also sometimes difficulty, sometimes small cooperation. There's now also an alliance of those Kurdish forces with other socialist forces in Iran, I don't know so well. But also especially with other ethnicities or peoples, especially after the revolution last year, there was a lot of strong approaches with Baluchi, Arab, and also Azeri, Azerbaijani. Communities, there was much more approach, and also the proposal of the Kurdish Liberation Movement to actually think and discuss about democratic nation for Iran. So how to overcome this Persian nationalism and how to build also a confederalism of the different communities, because Iran has also a lot of different peoples and religion and beliefs. Yes, I think I can give more or less this answer, but also maybe when you want, we can talk more later about it. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Oh, far away.
Hello. You mentioned eco-industrial society, and I was wondering to what extent it's been a reflection over it. Because, well, eco and industrial is kind of problematic for me, and because industry means hierarchy, means a structure that oppresses either the land or the people. So what's the reflection in this concept of eco-industrial society? Thanks.
Yes, for eco-industry, what I've said before, there's this understanding of rejecting industrialism, which, of course, is totally destroying any base of nature and also is part of capitalist exploitation of society. But industry, Öcalan understands more as systematic production of goods. So he says also industry, now capitalist modernity always claims that industrial revolution started 150 years ago, whereas he says actually when we had Neolithic revolution in Mesopotamia maybe 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, actually people already developed industry in a sense. Mills, or I don't know how to use, no, the mill, water mill, windmill. So it's also, actually the thought came out of society, and especially women played a very important role. So it's not to be against this, but how to use it in the right way. So industry, more like, and technology also. It's very much about this. What is an ethical, ecological approach to those, not to reject it in general, like to say, if we don't have it and we live primitive life, it's better. So more about this. And then how to have this as part of the democratic decision-taking in democratic confederalism. And it's one of the most difficult things, I would say, also nowadays, especially in a war situation. So Northeast Syria have very big problems to develop on this point, because you have bombings, you have embargo, you have no water, you have extreme heat. So it's one of the biggest difficulties right now also. Yes.
You mentioned that there are a lot of different like cultures and religions in Kurdistan, and I was wondering what is the answer of the movement to especially all these different religious groups, and if there's a perspective that at some point religion will transform into something that isn't something that is used as a power tool to oppress, but develops on, or if it's the idea is at some point just that religion and spirituality becomes irrelevant, or yeah, what is the answer of the Kurdish movement regarding that question?
There was one more.
You talked about this council system. I was wondering how they're working together on the different levels. Do council elect other councils on the more federative level, or do you know how it works?
Yeah, I mean, these are very detailed questions many times. And of course, not always theory and practice are the same, and it's a process. That's maybe first point. So there's, for example, difference between the experience in North Kurdistan and Turkey, difference also to Northeast Syria. But right now, for example, in Northeast Syria, there's also a good brochure on it from Rojava Information Center, where you have this, how we say, organigram. But right now it's a little bit mix of communal democracy, so total bottom-up, election of speakers of the communes, and then councils of the communes. But you have, at the same time, what I said also, you have also delegates then that are directly elected for different levels, for the councils, which is like kind of 40%, I think. So you have the federal, you have the direct elected with parliamentarian aspect, and then you have all the different delegates from civil society organizations. So it's a bit the mix. But the goal is to have really like bottom-up communal direct democratic system. In North Kurdistan, it was also more this, plus the delegates from different social movements. Yes. And second question. Yes. Yeah, it's an important question, I would say. Also, how to deal with religion, how to deal with not only religion, but social values. Or the question between tradition and traditionalism, or I don't know, tradition and conservatism. So I think it was a very important point for also the revolutionary movement in Kurdistan, why they were much more actually successful than other Marxist-Leninist organizations, because many Marxist-Leninists said religion is, I don't know how it's called, the sentence, opium for the people. So they just rejected it. And people were saying, you are infidels. We will not even talk to you. So it was not really able for them to reach broader parts of societies. I think also from anarchist point of view, very interesting to read Erich Mühsam here in his book, The Liberation of Society, if I'm not wrong. There he talks also a lot about the approach of anarchists to the church, where he says it's important to, or Öcalan says the same somehow, it's important first to accept the habits, the roots of all these things within society, but then to think how to actually confront it and work on it, how to get rid of the conservative patriarchal parts of it, and how to highlight also the good moral values within traditions and religion and so on. So the approach also, for example, to Islam is democratic Islam. There's like a federation even of this, even in Europe. So the question of actually how to highlight the democratic parts of Islam in order to also reform it. And yes, also let it be part of the democratic confederal structures rather than just rejecting it. But at the same time, you have also very radical feminist movement as part of the structure. So you create also automatically contradiction and change. But if you just, I think, if you just reject it, you will not create change. It will be polarization. So also democratic confederalism, we jumped this point of principles, I think, is to be open. To be open for very various forms of societal organization, but then to have also very clear common principles. And here, of course, it can be also jihadi movements will not be part of it, simply, or neoliberal capitalist forces will not be part of it. But to try to be as tolerant, transparent as possible. But then also the mental revolution is very important, to struggle, the ideological struggle. I think we come also now a bit to the role of the revolutionary organization. So it's more this accepting, but then also being able to struggle. Yes, for religion, I could say this point. I'm sorry for speaking fast. Yes. Maybe before we make more questions, I would go a little bit on with the next point. So this is the understanding of vanguard, party, political organization. I think the terminology here is not the most important, more the understanding or the philosophy behind it. So also the understanding of the party, because PKK is still a party, the Workers' Party of Kurdistan, and it was for a short while dissolved also after the paradigm shift, but then rebuilt. So the role of the political organization or the pioneer role of revolutionary organization in actually building the system of democratic modernity, maybe it's also an interesting point to share a bit. So the main understanding of also the revolutionary organization is to be kind of a prototype. So not to wait for the revolution to happen and build the social revolution after the crash of the state, but also what Sakine Janssens, the comrade that was murdered in Paris, used to say was, for us socialism is not utopia, but socialism for us is the daily life, the daily struggle. So we have to be socialist today. There's no after revolution or before revolution. So this is very important point also of the philosophy and the culture of the movement. So the revolutionary organization is also the organization with militants that try to live as much as possible according to the social values that is also your goal for the whole society. So vanguard in this understanding, not less talking, more practice, lifestyle. The way how you live is very important. So the question of how to live is the main question, I would say, behind all the theoretical debates in the movement. Wherever you are, always this question is the main point. And yes, in this sense also, I think also the term vanguard maybe, usually you don't become vanguard because you say, I am a vanguard. You become a vanguard because you do good things that solve problems of solve the problems of society. And then people follow you, or people join you. They say, this is a good thing, let's do it. So also, I think this is like the understanding behind is not to say we are vanguard, but to actually be able to solve the problems of society will make you a vanguard. Maybe this for the historical understanding. Also, when we look to that river again, there's millions of examples, right? Also, thousands of anarchist militants that in the end, today we remember them because they gave answers to questions in the right moment, and that's why people said, let's follow them. So it's more natural understanding also of leadership, not so much like hierarchical or state-like understanding of leadership. Yes, and then another very important aspect of the role of the revolutionary organization is to actually create this alternative modernity. So to really create social structures and mentality outside of capitalist modernity. So to really make a cut and try to build something on your own. And this is the main task also. And this, we can say it's then... one back, please. So, and this, of course, needs also clear program, strategy, tactics, and it needs also militants. You need to train militants with these ideas. Yes, it needs cadres. But one very important point in this also is the style. So it's not to have a dogmatic style, but also to how the Zapatistas say, no? We questioning ourselves, we walk forward. So to be able actually to make the society discuss these questions, to raise consciousness, have this dialectical approach, what I said before also. Accept things, but then struggle with them. Don't just like have this sectarian thing of rejecting, attacking, because in the end the state is here and it's everywhere and it's also inside ourselves, in our mentality. So when we accept that, we can struggle and fight against it. If not, we can't. So also again, the understanding of vanguard, and this is to start with ourselves, start with our own mentality, start with our own comrades and build what we actually want in our own life. Not just talking about it, but doing it. So this, I think, is one of the other understandings. And yes, and within this also, much more than maybe in the old paradigm, the role of militants is in this sense also much more ideological, philosophical, and also, yeah, a little bit like it needs some other aesthetics, right? Not like so much classical Marxist, Leninist aesthetics, but also you have to actually be part of society. You have to know society. You need to speak the language of society. And also the change is not only structure, but has also much to do with philosophical, cultural aspects. And in this sense also, yeah, sociological aspects. And the last point, I think also mainly, to be able to build with your own comrades and society that you are trying to reach for. So also comradeship, collectivity. This process can never be made individually. That's why it needs organization. Political, ideological organization. And then maybe some point adding on this, also the role of revolutionaries, of militants. So there are 3-4 main tasks that the movement always also highlights. It's like the role of initiating self-organization. Here also, I think, if I'm not wrong, maybe you can correct me, Kropotkin also has very similar understanding of that the role of militants is not to make the revolution for society, but to get rid of the obstacles for the social evolution to happen itself. So he said, actually, we have to get rid of the system within us and also attacking us daily life in order for the society to be able to actually just sustain itself. So Öcalan also says, the main role is this, initiating self-organization of the people, but initiating it, not go on the top and tell the people what to do, but create spaces like this for common discussions to come together, but the subject is the society itself. So not like in real socialism that in the end, everywhere in the management or in the leadership of things you had militants of the party, but that it's more like to initiate it, to run itself. The second thing then is the point of... the second important task is to build consciousness, so educational work. So what I said before, the ideological, philosophical role is much more important. So especially in all these academies that were built, for example, in Northeast Syria. Also, militants of the movement play a very important role to create spaces, both to share the ideas, the paradigm we are talking about, but then also to create a space for people that are actually part of the self-administration, part of the self-organization, to discuss together the problems they have, the difficulties, shortcomings, and then to also find solutions for it. So it's also kind of a social brain that is being created through the academies. So this conscious mentality revolution is very important, especially also connected to the women's liberation and genealogy, what I talked about. sorry, again, one left. Yeah, and yeah, the third important point is also that, of course, especially in Kurdistan, but of course, democratic modernity is a proposal also worldwide. But in the reality right now in Kurdistan, one of the main tasks of most of the militants is to be part of the self-defense, because you have very strong attacks. And in the sense also the role of building clandestine self-defense, people's self-defense, is one of the main roles also of the guerrilla. So not only to be professional army, but when we look for Rojava, YPG, YPG, the self-defense, people's self-defense forces and women's self-defense forces, also to build like, build structures for the society to be able to defend itself. This is also an important part of the revolutionary organization. And yes, also very, maybe one point, sorry. One last point, maybe also interesting, also connecting a bit to especifismo or plataformism, is the role of militants then in the social movements or of the revolutionary organization also. So to create platforms, alliances with other democratic forces. So not to say we are the only line, only our ideology counts. No, democratic modernity means there's many people, many organizations, movements, communities trying to build alternatives to the system. So how we can work together, how we find common points where we can build social movements. So also in this sense, to develop strategies, programs for this is one of the main roles of the political organization. Yeah, and here I think I said it before, but the different layers also of creating consciousness, building democratic society organizations, establishing different political parties or alliances, whatever is needed. And the umbrella of all this is then a People's Congress. So Northeast Syria, for example, has this People's Congress where all these different things come together. And the goal is to build something like that for whole Kurdistan, or also for the Middle East. Yes, this point also, good point. I mentioned before, that, again, this dual understanding. So for the actual question of how to do the revolution, of course, when you build your own structures, your democratic autonomy, there can be two options somehow. Either the state says, okay, I recognize you, or you make the state recognize you, maybe it's more like that. For example, Chiapas, we can see, they have created certain democratic autonomy, and they have not too much attacks, at least, at the moment. There's kind of, I don't know what is the official agreement, but the Mexican nation state at least somehow tolerating it. But at the same time, it can be very fast a situation where the state, the forces, capital forces will attack you. So one of the options also for Kurdistan democratic autonomy is to be officially recognized by nation states and kind of guarantee the existence like this, which so far didn't happen, and it's very unlikely, I would say. And the other option is that you're going to be attacked, what is happening every day, and you are going to defend yourself against this. And this understanding also, again, what I said, the strategy is revolutionary people's war, so that the whole society is aware of the situation that if you build your democratic autonomy, you're going to be attacked. So also your democratic autonomy has not to be built only on, how you say, like just, yeah, you have to be aware that whatever you build, it has to have its own self-defense. And the more stronger you organize, the more you can defend yourself also. So in that sense also, especially Northeast Syria, for example, now there's like two cities. You have a city above and below, similar to Vietnam, everywhere tunnel structures, because simply you are being bombed every day by drone attacks. Yes, and here maybe some places for the comrades that haven't heard about it, where we have concrete practice of implementation also. So I talked about North Kurdistan. It was mainly crushed after 2015-16 by the Turkish state, but still existing in the one or the other way. Then Rojava, or Northeast Syria it's now, because it's also a lot of Arab territories. And then in South Kurdistan, so North Iraq, you have Mahmud, which is like a refugee camp, kind of a prototype of democratic confederalism. Also, Evin Gui, that she was assassinated in Paris. All her family is in that refugee camp because their villages were burned in the 90s and they didn't accept to go to Turkish metropoles. So they went to live with the guerrilla in the mountains and later were pushed to the desert in Iraq. And now they build like democratic confederalist life there with kind of 15,000 people. And also Shengal, which is also a mountain in North Iraq, the mountain where mostly Kurdish Yazidi people live, that also built their own Shengal Democratic People's Council. Yeah, if you want, you can research these things also more deeper. Then one last point I wanted to open before we can also have more questions or contributions of the friends here is also the international proposals of Öcalan, especially in the book Sociology of Freedom. We have also these brochures over there on a table where you can also read more about it. So he talks also about the tasks of rebuilding democratic modernity. So his understanding of strengthening the alternative to capitalist modernity, how to systematize it. So there's a big chapter where he's analyzing or reflecting about the state of anti-system forces, what he calls, so the legacy of re-socialism, communism, the anarchist movements, at the same time feminist ecological movements, but also what he calls cultural movements, so democratic nation, indigenous struggles, but also, how we say, like local city autonomies, neighborhood assemblies to, I don't know, regional autonomous regions. And he is kind of analyzing those also as the strategic partners of the Kurdistan Freedom Movement, but also as part of this democratic modernity. So in this sense, he also makes some proposals of how to work together as anti-system forces, or what he calls also democratic forces or forces of democratic modernity. And here he talks especially about three tasks. One is the intellectual tasks, one the moral tasks, and one political tasks. Yes, and when he talks about intellectual tasks, there's lots of points, but one example maybe is that he makes the proposal of building a confederation, world confederation of different academies or alternative autonomous education networks as a very concrete point, but generally also highlighting that there's a big need actually for a conscious revolution also, or like a ideological intellectual struggle against the capitalist modernity and especially liberalism. Because when we look to those anti-state forces, I think we also agree here, one of the very big problems we are facing is this approach of the capitalist modernity of liberalizing movements, co-opting movements. When we look to 20th century social democrat movements, I don't have to mention even, in 20th century, but also today, it's a big problem, for example. When we look to Podemos, Syriza, they built leftist parties after people's uprisings to then destroy the leftist movements or anarchist movements. Even I think in UK now, a lot of anarchists joined the election campaign for, how is it called? For Corbyn, So I think this is one of the points where we see how movements get co-opted. National liberation movements, most of them, even they succeeded in national revolution, afterwards they built new nation states. And so they got rid of colonization of other states, but in the end we have again nation state structures. And also the other movements in the 20th century and that also we see in the 21st century now have a lot of problem with being co-opted by the capitalist modernity, especially also I think more the postmodern developments after 68 feminist movements. Now we have Annalena Baerbock, foreign minister of Germany, saying I do, how is she calls it, feminist foreign policy, but at the same time bombing Women's Liberation Army in Kurdistan. And more examples of this, or we have, I don't know, a lot of these examples. And I think this is also something where Öcalan talks a lot about, how to actually make an intellectual, ideological revolution in order to defend ourselves against this co-option. Yes. Then for the moral tasks, he talks a lot about also the question of how to make a society be able to solve its own problems again, how to get rid of the justice system of the state, the bourgeoisie law, and only using punishment. So now the question of also how to find ways of solving problems in communal way. There's also these concepts, I think, in the West, transformative justice and so on. So this is a very important part, and here he proposes, for example, maybe a very big utopic idea, federation of different belief and faith groups. So also to bring peace between these polarization between different religions, and how to, what I said before, democratize religion, to get rid of popes and, I don't know, male figures running the representative of religions, how to bring it back to the people again. Yes. Yeah, and for the political task, the main proposal he makes is actually to use also the concept of democratic modernity, where he again says it's not so much about the term, but the, yes, kind of the imagination of so much alternatives all over the world that actually have similar goals, trying to push back capitalist modernity, but have not systematized themselves. How to actually find the political agreement or political structure, how to bring all those people together, how to build networks between these movements. And there he says, he proposes democratic confederalism worldwide, actually. So regional for continents, but also worldwide democratic confederalism. And in this sense also, yeah, again, using this idea of politics as an art of freedom and also building democratic autonomy as counter power to the state. And here again, not waiting for doing this only in one region, but understanding it also more international in the sense that even a little neighborhood assembly or an international federation or indigenous struggle or a socialist anarchist movement, anywhere, no matter where they are, or if they live inside democratic, inside nation states, they can anyway try to build the alternative from now on. So also the spirit of World Social Forum to actually discuss how we can again build new internationals and strong alliance against capitalist modernity. Here he has also these proposals of thinking about the concept of worldwide democratic confederalism. Yes. yes, and maybe I will say a few points also about the academy before we can make a last round of questions. So the Academy of Democratic Modernity has also the goal to share these concepts, the ideas, the theory of democratic modernity, and the experiences also from the revolution in Kurdistan. We are a team of people from many different countries, from Kurdistan, Middle East, but also Europe, Latin America, and yeah, trying to disseminate these ideas, both through publications. So we have different brochures. We had also a book stand here, bookstore here, and at the same time also by political education. So we organize different conferences, seminars, events like this, talks, in order to make this theory more known and also to discuss it with other movements. So it's also a main goal to discuss together. Maybe the format today is more presentation because it's a lot of information, but also I'm welcome, or we all welcome here, the comrades, also to discuss afterwards more together. Yes, we have a website. Here's some of our brochures. We have in many different languages. Here, some posters of our conferences and events that we also organize. For example, we are part of the network for an alternative quest that is organizing the big conference in Hamburg every few years, which brings together different academic intellectuals to discuss common points around this ideas of democratic modernity. We have also right now, next weekend, a big conference similar to this with different social movements in Latin America, where also these common points there and the proposal of new concepts are being discussed with other social movements over there. And at the same time, we also participate in a lot of other conferences that other movements organize. Many anarchists, indigenous, socialist, feminist events that we participate. And yes, this is maybe what I can say about the Academy. And one of our main goals is also to highlight or to strengthen these ideas of international networking, international cooperation, because we also believe we are not in the best situation. The stand or the situation of anti-system forces could be much stronger. And maybe the objective conditions are quite on our side, but many times I think we are still struggling with ourselves to organize ourselves better, to have stronger ideological understanding of the situation. So also with our debates and political education, we are trying to bring together all these experiences of different movements in order to actually strengthen this democratic modernity alternative. And yes, this is maybe to explain a little bit about the Academy. And I don't know what time it is now. Okay, so we have like 15 minutes, 10 minutes more, because we need to give the projector to another group. Yes, so if you have other questions, contributions, contradictions also, feel free.
Hi, thank you. I'll be in English. If you're interested in going to Kurdistan yourself and supporting there, is it like, do they want you to come there, and where can I find information on that?
My question is, I know that there is the method of critique and self-critique. It's on one hand a method to organize, but also to struggle together. And I want to ask what role it plays within the self-organized structures.
Other questions?
I will try to make a question in English, but I think this question must be discussed like for an hour or two, but I give the question because many of things that you say, I mean, I think in neoliberalism is not only a political economical system, it's only an anthropological system. And one of the thing is, because we speak less about this anthropological system of neoliberalism, impose in all around the world. And one of this anthropological way of view is do it yourself, organize yourself, be autonomous, be auto-entrepreneur, you know? For sure, be happy and be transversal. All this discourse is really powerful. And I know people who organize in this alternative, you say, in agriculture, with small agriculture people, you know, small farms. And in Europe, it doesn't work. They work like for 20 years, they're really precarious. They don't change anything in the system, in agriculture system. So they make a book about, they self-critique themselves, actually. They really understand that we must to get into the opposition that you say is not good. You must to be more political. Go to the fight with a conservative. Get to the public discussion, and they don't do that. They think, as you say, like do your thing in your alternative, and then all these small islands will be connected, and we are going to change. This kind of discourse is, for my point of view, is dangerous because it's like an illusion, and we less be more in the opposition and the fight in the political way, many ways. But this is a really huge discussion because it's the same discussion of the neoliberalism. This is why this work today. And the second example you say of autonomies, Kurdistan and Chiapas. I come from Peru. Okay, but we speak about Occident, Europe. James C. Scott, the anthropologist, who is a master of anarchy, say, yeah, sorry guys, but in Europe, in Occident, maybe we must to domesticate the state. Maybe it's not real to disappear the state. So, I mean, I'm not against this alternative small islands, but I mean, I ask for also fight outside the island and try to domesticate the state, because we are, as you say, I agree with that part. The revolution is not going to, for tomorrow, but the thing is, if I do my old stuff, my alone with my friends, it's neoliberalism. I mean, and it's an illusion, and you must also fight and be in the opposition. Choose the way you can do it, but I mean, Chiapas and Kurdistan is outside Europe and outside Occident, so that is another situation. So you use example that is in different context. Okay, it's not the same context. In Peru, we don't have a state. Many people die because we don't have any security of hospitals, and the people don't know how to organize. So it could be dangerous too. You know, I mean, as an immigrant, I hate the state in Switzerland because I receive letters of go away. You know, I know the state in Switzerland. You know, I'm not for, but I mean, it's more. But we must discuss that for a serious discussion, not for 15 minutes or 5 minutes, you know. Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot for your exposition.
Any other questions?
Thank you. I just wanted to know more about the economic organization that takes place there in the Rojava. Thank you.
I will really try to be short because you have so little time, and I think I do too now. Somebody asked me a question yesterday, and I just was not able to answer it. Perhaps some of you have already heard me. I'm no anarchist, at least not officially, and I'm just at heart with, I see that we have convergent goals for our life and for the future, okay? So I'm in affinity, morally, should I say, or whatever. What I want to say is I don't want to leave this place without sharing one thing, which is a reason why I came here. I've got at least for 10 years, I've been in a fight with this system, you know, which is so corrupt. And in these 10 years, I've lost a lot of very dear things. But I've found also that how can I say? I hated the state. I hated even the people who work in the state because they lied to me so much. You know, they fooled around with me so much. And I just couldn't stand that, you know, even people who are supposed to have ethics and who don't. But I found out at one point, and that's after much suffering, I found out that there are people even in the state. I used to, you know, I'm a Swiss, 66 years old, and I used to like the police, and I was thankful we had the police like we had 60 years ago, you know? I was very thankful because they did protect us as individuals. They don't today anymore. And your message really takes a dimension which is very real to me, which I've lived now for almost more than 10 years, because I have a daughter who is a drug addict, and I can tell you that these people are not even human beings. You know, they're not human beings. What they can do to them is just infinite evil, you know, very evil. So I'll try to make it short, excuse me. What I mean is I've reached a point where I've realized that not everybody in the system likes the way it is and the things they are themselves doing, you know. They have to lie to us. We all have representatives, you know, representatives that not only represent our ideas, they don't do that at all. They represent us as thinking beings, I mean, they think for us. That's what they do. They decide for us. And all this is really embedded in the system and grafted in it. It has been done over the last century, I believe. Some people gave, I think, the revolution, the French Revolution, but it became so terrible in the last, ever since Schengen. So what I want to say is, now there are people who really want something to change, but who can't. Even some people like journalists, you know, I'm very discouraged about journalists and even investigative journalists. I had to go through that. I went to Munich to talk to the two guys, you know, the Meyer something, you know, who received the Panama Papers data, you know, and all this. I'd like to quickly share. We are all, and I'm sure you are too, I know I found my whole family in the Panama Papers data. You know, my whole family is there on the corporations, companies, and all sorts of things. So these people do these things on our names. And I just was so desperate. I said, how can we fight this on the individual level? Not in the name of a group. No, no, they can fight the group. They have everything in it. You go down on the street, they'll just pull whatever they have, weapons they have on you, you know. But as a person, I have an identity, and that's what I'm defending. I'm defending my identity, the right to be a person who thinks and who have a say about the things that are done on my name. And this is what I came here with. Unfortunately, I was hoping it would be done already when I came, but I couldn't finish it totally. But what I'm working on now, which is almost done, and I hope I'll have time to do it before somebody snatches it, it's a proxy. A proxy, that's the problem. These people are proxies to us. Yeah, I'll try to make it short, really. But it's a proxy. Give the right, because our laws took the right, even from the police, even if there are still some honest policemen left, you know, they have no right to touch certain subjects, private subjects. And it's all in the law that we can undo all this. So I'm making a proxy that will go to people that I trust. I have nothing more to lose anyway. If they stab me in the back, really, I have nothing more to lose but my own life, and that'll be a deliverance. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I just want to say I'm making a proxy. If somebody wants to know proxy, what it's made
maybe
of.
You can continue because you take a lot of space.
Yeah. So okay. Okay. I'll be outside now. I'm going to leave. But I'll be out. Turning around, if you want to see the text and if you want to understand a little bit more of this, I believe this is it, you know. We all have, we're going to have representatives in our passports.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for questions and contributions. I have 5 minutes, I think, for answering. So maybe I will start with your point. And I think you are very right that many of the concepts and ideas are already also anticipated by neoliberal capitalist ideologies, and they are really trying hard to co-opt those. The understanding of autonomy, turning it into something friendship, entrepreneur, individual thing. But of course, when we talk about it, we talk about it from a socialist or from a social anarchist point of view, in the sense of that it is something communal, collective, confrontative also, of course. So I think I agree there is this danger, but I think then it's also up to us how we build these alternatives and understanding of autonomy. And of course, also in Kurdistan, the USA, European Union, they try very hard to turn the things into a more neoliberal understanding. And the struggle now in Kurdistan is mainly ideological, right? Not only militarily, because they also talk about confederation system of Middle East, dissolving the nation states into more little parts, for example. So connecting to this also, I think the question of critique and self-critique is maybe the main point also. So how to actually be able to have an internal ideological struggle, not to be co-opted by neoliberalism, and how to defend the third line, neither neoliberal ideology nor the old school status quo nation state conservative revolution that Dugin and the Russians are now talking about. So I think in this sense it's important to how we build our own line. No, and this we have a lot of examples in history, also I think in the Occident. So of course the situation is very different, I agree. But the understanding of the revolution is right now, and the potential lays in society, I think it's still the same philosophy. Then the tactic of how to confront the state, I agree with you. Maybe there will be other tactics. Maybe sometimes it will be also we need to go, there's also municipalist comrades here. We need to go into some communal elections and change something inside. But again, if we don't have strong social movement, I guess it won't be possible to, how you said, domesticate the state. It's up to our strength, our democratic people's strength also. Maybe for this point, but we can discuss also afterwards. I agree, it's a long discussion, and this is the main discussion we want to open. How we can learn from this for here. I don't say it's copy-paste. No, it's part of discussion. And for the economical organization, I mean, I said already, this is one of the most difficult challenges. But as I said, the goal is mainly cooperative economy, socialist market in the sense of democratic decision taking of how things are being handled also in exchange, and especially also democratic controlled economy. And right now, Rojava, Northeast Syria, if I'm not wrong, you can again read in the brochures of Rojava Information Center, is one third more or less cooperative economy, one third like little business market economy, but it's mostly like family business, and one third is like central companies or agriculture of the self-administration that was before state-owned companies. So it's like a mix of the different things, and constantly that attempt to strengthen the cooperative communal economy. There's also a book, I can maybe ask for support here also, of Aziza Aslan, that she wrote a book about anti-capitalist economy in Rojava in Spanish. So if there's anyone very excited about helping us to translate it to German or English and French, we would be very, very happy, because it's a very good and important book, and it could give some of more deeper answers also to the question. Yeah, then critique and self-critique, I think, it's a very important point. Maybe I didn't mention so much, but the philosophy of ideological struggle within the revolutionary movement, within society, but also with the own personality, is a very important part of the philosophy of Öcalan and the movement. There was this sentence in 86 when guerrilla started to evolve and becoming bigger and having a lot of problems also, in one of the Congress, which was, we are not analyzing only the person, but society, and we are not only analyzing the moment, but history. I think this is very well, explaining also the philosophy behind critique and self-critique. So this method of critique and self-critique, you have it all over the movement, as in philosophy, but also in all the structures of committees, commissions, councils, communes, and the women's movement, youth movement, play extra important role here. So also against bureaucratization, against, the danger of power. No, Bakunin also used to say, even the best anarchist, if he sits for one day, or I don't know how much he said, on the throne, he will become also kind of dictator personality. So critique and self-critique tries to fight against those power dynamics within the movement also. One more question was there. For going there. As you know also, there's a lot of internationalists that went to Kurdistan since the 80s already. There was many delegations also visiting Öcalan in that time. And the movement was very open for this always, for exchange, according to their abilities, situation also, because it's also a very difficult struggle. You have war. But the movement is really pushing also for this international exchange. So in Rojava, you have different international academies, projects from women's movement. You have a lot of different projects where one can take part in. Many of them you find also online. You can write to them. Then also, of course, the diplomacy or the international affairs of the Kurdistan movement here in Europe also regularly organize delegations, for example, to different parts of Kurdistan. For example, in January, I think, is going to be again the communal elections in Turkey. So to have a lot of international support, for example, for those would be very, very good, because it will be another step for Erdogan fascism to try to strengthen itself. And the communal level is very important for the Kurdish movement, because it's where it's the more important to have also a big strength. So people can go, for example, for observation of these elections. Yes, and also I think when we look to the revolution in Rojava, it's also a lot of similarities, right, with Spanish Revolution. In 2014 already, Öcalan from prison, when he could still speak to the outside, he made that proposal of having international brigades to come and defend the revolution against the Islamic State. Many did so, but much less than in Spain. It was 60,000. And also many of them lost their life, in fact. Yes, so also there was memorial of Dima Petrov. The other day he was, for example, also one of those volunteers that went to fight in Rojava, and also other anarchists that lost their life in the struggle there. So, of course, the international solidarity in this sense of going there is very important, but maybe even more important is also to play our role in the center of these states that are supporting the colonization and supporting Turkish fascism. Switzerland is one of them. Most of the other countries where many comrades here come from as well, I would say, especially Germany, France, that are very strongly supporting Turkish fascist state. So in that sense, also here to confront those imperial and fascist politics by the European nation states is really important. So the spirit of internationalism, I think, also has been shown more or less a little bit yesterday in the participation of the demonstration. And also, I think, to just also engage with the movement and discuss together how to strengthen together alternatives is also a very big contribution, besides going there, learning, participating, supporting. So maybe I can say these points as last words. And the time is over. I'm sorry for speaking too fast. I'm not good in it, in this speaking slowly when there's a lot of people. Also a bit of excitement, big room. And I thank you for listening. And if you have more questions, you can come to us. As I said, there are some brochures here, and also in the big hall, we have some more books and things in different languages. Thank you.